This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Welcome to Through the Ringer. I'm your host, Tate Frazier. We have a jam-packed show today, and joining us at the top to talk about the NBA playoffs and break down all the major storylines, you know him from TheRinger.com. He is the great Howard Beck. Howard, good to see you, man.
Great to see you. Good to be back. It's been a while.
Been a while, and we got a lot to talk about because a lot is happening right now. As we've seen in the playoff commercial with Jason Tatum, we are in playoff mode right now, and everyone is talking about the playoffs. And we're going to start in the Eastern Conference today. We're going to start with probably the most interesting matchup here. We got Sixers Knicks. Sixers -106 in this series. Knicks -114, which means Vegas has no idea which way this is going to go. We got a lot of storylines here, Howard. Just your first impressions of this matchup between the Sixers and the Knicks going to New York for this first game.
Should be a blast. You know, I don't think it's these teams have matched up in literally decades. I think the replays or the highlights I was seeing last night from the last time Charles Barkley was in a Sixer uniform. So it's been a while. Obviously, the proximity makes it a little bit fun. I think fans will travel. The Garden will be crazy. Sixers Arena, whatever they're calling it these days, will be crazy. They rename it every 5 seconds.
Yes.
But it listen, you mentioned it, like, this is a really hard to handicap series from a lot of different vantage points, not least of which, of course, is the fact that Joel Embiid doesn't quite look like himself. And, you know, this is a guy who, when he was before he went down a couple months ago with the knee, was looking very much like not just a two-time MVP. He was better than in his MVP season.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not seen that Embiid yet since he returned. And so, you know, obviously the Sixers' biggest advantage is Joel Embiid, but only if he's, you know, 75, 80, 90% of Joel Embiid at least. So that makes it interesting and I think kind of hard to assess.
Well, the Knicks, they earned that 2 seed. They earned home court. There were some people that raised their eyebrows at their decision to go for it. Tom Thibodeau, just knowing his makeup, there was no way he was not going to go for that 2 seed. Does the home court for the Knicks matter in this series? Like, is it going to be something that we come back to and say that was actually a very advantageous thing for them to have home court because MSG was the magical difference in them winning this series?
I try not to put too much on home court when it comes to veteran teams. I tend to think that younger teams need that safety net more. I don't think the Knicks necessarily need it. I don't think the Sixers need it. All that said, if you saw and heard the Garden this time last year when it was Knicks-Cavaliers, and here the Knicks were having home games with full crowds for the first time in like a decade or whatever it been, because they'd been in the playoffs a few years ago coming out of COVID, but it was not full capacity yet. It was insane. And it absolutely had an impact on the Cavaliers, psychologically, emotionally, whatever. Like, the Cavs looked spooked by just the atmosphere. I don't think that's going to happen with a Sixers team that's very veteran, although Tyrese Maxey's playing a much bigger role than he ever has in the past, and he's on the younger side. So, yeah, it could have an impact. But you know what? Sixers crowd gets pretty raucous, too, so...
Yeah, let's talk about that. The Sixers, they booed their team in the first quarter in the play-in game. And then things turned around with some free chicken. Caleb Martin missed two free throws, and all of a sudden the Sixers crowd was back into it. How do we feel about the Sixers' response? I thought that was actually a good sign that they were down early against the Heat. It looked like at halftime things were going to go sideways for them, but they bounced back and they get a win. Is that encouraging heading into the series? Do we have more belief in the Sixers?
Yes, but I don't think you're planning on, like, you know, 20-point explosions from Nick Batum every night, you know. I mean, Embiid said it himself after the game that, you know, Batum won that game for them in the fourth quarter, and that's great. They do have some good role players, and playoffs often turn on you know, which role player for which team got hot on a given night or a given quarter. So, you know, that's a perfectly, you know, fine way to win a game and potentially to win a series. But listen, this really, for the Sixers, this is about Embiid and Maxey, right? Like, those are your stars. Tyrese Maxey, I think, did a phenomenal job this season of stepping into a much bigger role with James Harden's departure, having all the responsibility of the playmaking and the scoring. And then on top of that, Embiid goes out, and now it's on you. And yeah, they struggled, and he struggled at times without Embiid, and that's going to happen. But Maxey had an outstanding season. He's probably not making all NBA, but he was on the fringes of that discussion, and he will in the future. If Maxey is up to the task in this atmosphere and under this kind of spotlight, and if Embiid, again, can summon or get back to some semblance of himself, then the Sixers have a really good shot. You know, the Knicks are not exactly some star-studded crew, right? It's Jalen Brunson just constantly willing these guys to win after win after win. And as a result, a 50-win season that nobody saw coming in a second-place finish in the East. You could say, well, the East is a down year, and the Cavs kind of tanked out of that spot, and the Bucks were, you know, whatever's going with the Bucks, and Giannis is out. All that's true. But the Knicks are the team that nobody wants to face. They never, ever, ever relent. And Brunson is the epitome of that. So this is one of those series where you can't necessarily say, like, who's got the most stars. That's the team that's going to win. It's going to be based on talent. It may just be based on will, and the Knicks are certainly overflowing with that.
Yeah, Jalen Brunson and the Villanova Knicks, they figure out a way to win games, and that's what it comes down to. So that's the 2-7 matchup. Let's look at the 3-6 matchup. We got the Pacers taking on the Bucks. This has been a fascinating matchup throughout the year. The Pacers have kind of owned the Bucks a little bit. If you look at the odds here, Pacers plus 100, Bucks minus 118. Giannis is the talking point, and his status in general. If Giannis does not play in this series, as most speculate, at least a few games, the first few games, where do we kind of feel like, what is the ceiling of this Bucks team without Giannis?
I mean, look, it's still a veteran team, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Damian Lillard's been in a lot of playoff games and a lot of series. Chris Middleton and Brooke Lopez, you know, holdovers, and Bobby Portis, holdovers from a championship team with the Bucks. And so you've got a lot of capable, seasoned, proven players against an unseasoned, unproven Pacers team that's just getting here for the first time. Granted, Siakam won a championship in Toronto, but Tyrese Halliburton and the rest of that crew is pretty young and don't have really any postseason experience to speak of. I would, the optimist's view for the Bucks would be that the veteran strength and experience carries them through, and that Damian Lillard can still, on a given night, be the old Damian Lillard. The concern I would have if it's just Dame and no Giannis is this: he's just not the same Damian Lillard, and that's not a knock. Like, he's got a lot of years and a lot of miles on him. He shot 35% on threes this season. The league average for threes this season was 36.6%. So Dame Lillard, one of the most legendary shooters of all time, shot below the league average on threes this year. Among all the players in the NBA who had at least 5 3-point attempts per game, Lillard was 76th in accuracy.
Wow.
So he's just not the same guy. Now, if you style an entire offense around him and just make it the Dame show as it was in Portland all those years, maybe there's more comfort level there, and maybe that goes up, as opposed to, like, having to, you know, figure out the ways to play off Giannis, which was the whole experiment this season.
Yeah.
Their defense is going to suffer too without Giannis, lest we forget. Like, the Bucks, you know, that's been their backbone for a long time. And you're just not the same defensive unit without him either. So it becomes a toss-up.
Yeah, that rim protection with Brook Lopez and Giannis Antetokounmpo, it was tough to match that. It's an elite level. Obviously, Brook has dipped off a little bit, but still, when you have both those guys, it makes a difference. Let's talk about the coaches, Doc Rivers versus Rick Carlisle. Obviously, a lot of experience between those two coaches and a matchup that'll be fascinating. What do we expect to see here, and what can Rick Carlisle kind of do to throw Doc off a little bit in this series?
Hard to say. I mean, look, these are both championship coaches, and again, very, very experienced. There's nothing that either of them haven't seen. I tend to think, generally speaking, playoff series don't come down to X's and O's as much as they just come down to sheer talent. Who's just got the better players? And you know, I don't particularly give the advantage to either side on this one. But I'll be curious to see how they each approach this, especially if Giannis isn't there.
Yeah, it's going to be a fascinating matchup. Let's look at the 4-5 matchup. The Cavs kind of tanked into this matchup. So we got the 4-5 here. Magic plus 166, Cavs minus 198. If you're the Magic, do you like this matchup against the Cavs? And the Cavs have more experience, obviously, than Magic. But Magic, very physical team. And we saw the Cavs last year struggle with the physicality of the Knicks.
Well, and besides that, the Cavaliers, their firepower is all with that backcourt, right? Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland. And there have been times this season where they were better with just one or the other. And the two-year experiment of those two guys as a 1-2 punch, as a partnership, I think it's still, it never has clicked, I don't think, which is why many of us believe that one or the other will be moved eventually. But in the present here, the Magic strength, aside from Paolo Banchero obviously doing a lot of things with the ball in his hands, is their defense. They're a phenomenal defensive team. And that's about Jalen Suggs, who's absolutely just relentless as an on-ball defender. He's going to be all defensive team, probably all defensive first team. Jonathan Isaac would be right there too if he qualified, but he does not. And the two of those guys, with all their tenacity and length and mobility, throwing them against those two guards, like that could be a really tough task for the Cavaliers. Like, yes, the Cavs have the playoff experience, having been in it last year. They have the star power. But, you know, if there's a team that can really throttle that backcourt, it might just be the Magic.
And it does feel like the Magic have a lot of good mojo going into the playoffs, a lot of excitement. Their fans are locked in. You know, we've been hearing the Magic song the entire season. So I'm excited to see what Orlando can do in the postseason. And Paolo Banchero, this could be one of those times where he could send a message. He did not make Team USA, obviously made a decision to play Team USA over Italy, but he can send a message to the rest of the NBA that he is here. He is arriving. So I'm excited to see what happens there in the 4-5 game. A lot of good matchups there in the East. Last one, and we want to talk about the play-in, the finale preview that's coming up tonight. We got the Bulls taking on the Heat. This is a redux of what we saw last year. Jimmy Butler not going to be a part of this matchup. Caruso also had the Drummond ankle foot injury that happened during the game two nights ago. What do we expect to see here? And do we think the Bulls and Kobe White can maybe make some magic and get into the playoffs?
I make a motion to wipe this game off the books. Just cancel it. Like, this is like the biggest bummer. Like, I love the play-in. The play-in in the East this year is actually just one big bummer bracket, and this one has become the ultimate version of that now, with no Jimmy Butler, as far as you know, all the reports are, and probably no Caruso, and these teams are just banged up, and they had bad records, and one of them is going to win just to become cannon fodder in the first round. So, and we should remind ourselves too, like the Heat going from play-in to finals last year, the Lakers going from play-in to conference final. That's not the norm. The broad history of this league is that seventh and eighth seeds are cannon fodder. And that's really the reward for whoever wins this game tonight.
Yeah, you're going to go up against one of the best teams we've seen in the Eastern Conference in a long time, in the Boston Celtics. I would ask you, like, if you are the Celtics, are you watching this play-in game? Are you scouting these teams? Are you just kind
sure,
of just...
Of course.
Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah,
okay,
no,
that's good.
Yeah, of course. And by the way, like, you know, not to dump on them too much, but both these teams, even without key players and their records notwithstanding, these are really hard-playing teams. They bust their butts. And so... you can't take them for granted. The talent level is not high enough, and especially if guys are hurt, it's a problem. The Celtics should roll whoever it is, but yeah, there's a healthy respect there for guys like DeMar DeRozan, for guys like Bam Adebayo. The Celtics will be scouting and watching, I have no doubt.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun run there in the Eastern Conference, and we got some great matchups. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back with Howard, we're going to run through the Western Conference matchups and see what Howard thinks about all those storylines. We'll be right back on the other side.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local, wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with Howard Beck, and we are running through all of the matchups in the NBA playoffs. So now we're going to head to the Western Conference, and we're going to turn a fascinating conversation here with the Lakers and the Nuggets. We saw these teams last year in the Western Conference Finals. It ended up being a sweep for the Nuggets, but it was closer than people remember. Right now, if you look at the odds, Lakers +310, Nuggets -400. So I ask a simple question to you, Howard. The Lakers win this series against the defending champs if they do this. What do they need to do to win this series?
Anthony Davis has to win his matchup with Jokic. I hate to reduce it to the most obvious thing on earth, but I think that's a lot of this. Like, Anthony Davis, the Lakers need to feature him and feed him and so that he can try to wear out Jokic if Jokic is even guarding him, right? Like, they may mix it up. They may throw Aaron Gordon on him or whatever. But Anthony Davis needs to make Jokic work at both ends, make him less efficient. We know what Jokic will do if you don't give him room to shoot. He's just going to find guys cutting and backdooring. It's really hard to do anything to disrupt Jokic. But if Anthony Davis doesn't at least wear him down and make him work, make him less efficient, then they've got no shot at all. But if we're talking about how the Lakers win this, which I think most people will agree is a pretty big long shot. But the other piece of it is, like, what if Jamal Murray's not 100%? Like, he's, he was banged up down the stretch of the season. And, you do need a second star most of the time in this league to make a deep run. And Jamal Murray cooked the Lakers last year when we focused so much on Jokic, and for good reason. But Murray averaged 32.5 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, and almost 3 steals in that sweep. So, the Nuggets certainly need a fully functioning Jamal Murray.
Yeah, I remember last year. I mean, the vision that comes to my mind of that series was he hit a shot over LeBron, a step back three, and LeBron gave him the thumbs up afterwards. I mean, that's how good Jamal Murray was in that series. I do think if you're the Lakers, you have to play the Nuggets at some point to get through the West. So it's better to play them early, right, than to play them later. Just talking about fresh legs, is that actually a good thing for them to play them in the first round?
I mean, I think it probably is, only because, yes, it's the Lakers' legs that need to be fresh, right? Like, you could make the argument if you're a different team, well, if we get the Nuggets later, maybe they're worn down or somebody else has given them, what if the Lakers push them to 7 and the Nuggets are tired for their second round series? You could spin it that way. But if you're the Lakers, look, you've got a 39-year-old LeBron James and Anthony Davis with a lot of miles. Both those guys are always banged up. I think you want to get them earlier than later before you get too banged up, for sure.
Yeah, I thought that was actually good gamesmanship. I saw a lot of people talking about the Lakers trying to avoid the Nuggets, but playing them sooner rather than later. Yeah, that was all very silly. I'm glad we're on the same page with that. Next one, we got the 4 seed taking on the 5 seeds. We got Mavs coming to town to LA to take on the Clippers. I'm going to be at this game, Howard, so I'm excited to see this in person. A lot of talk about both these teams, a lot of excitement about Luka. Kawhi, according to Ty Lue, should be playing in game 1, so that'll be a fun matchup. Who do you like to win this series, and what's kind of the key matchup that you're going to be tuning in for?
This is a really tough one again. And I hate the fact that in so many of these situations or these series, we're looking at it going, well, if player X is healthy or player X is a little close to, like, it's almost every series. And in this one, it's Kawhi. Like, Ty Lue is saying he's going to play, but he also was not, I don't think he was playing 5-on-5 the other day, the last time Ty gave an update. So, is he really going to play in game one? Is that gamesmanship? Is that just misdirection? What does he look like when he gets on the court? Is Kawhi fully 100%? So I think I lean Mavericks. Like, this is a really hard to call series. I would lean Mavericks mostly because if Kawhi's status is in doubt or his ability to be 100% is in doubt, that puts a lot of pressure on everybody else, right? Like, all right, Paul George is a phenomenal talent and he can carry you for sure at times. But then your second guy is Harden, who... Well, we know James Harden's postseason history. So the beauty of having Harden on the Clippers is that you don't need him to be the guy who carries it in playoff games under high pressure, that you can have Kawhi and Paul George do that. But if Kawhi is not himself, that's going to make it tough on the Clips.
Yeah, I think most people are going to talk about Luka versus Kawhi, but Kyrie versus James Harden, I think that's a fascinating matchup. Obviously, former teammates as well. Can Kyrie kind of be a guy that can play at that all-star level that we've seen before? Can he swing this series? And what do we expect to see from him in this series?
Kyrie Irving absolutely can swing a series. It's been a long time since we've seen him at his peak in the postseason, right? Because the Nets run was so messy. His run with the Celtics was messy. Like, the last time we really saw Kyrie playing meaningful playoff games deep in the playoffs was before he decided he didn't want to play with LeBron James anymore, oddly. A decision that I think really has backfired on him, you know, in terms of the totality of his career. But Kyrie's been awesome in Dallas. I will be the first to say I was absolutely wrong about the potential partnership there with Kyrie and Luka. I did not think it was a good fit. Partially that's because of just trust issues with Kyrie in general. Partially it's just because two incredibly ball-dominant players, scorer, playmaker types in the same backcourt, it's hard. And Luka's usage rate is just, you know, through the roof night after night. But Kyrie has done a great job of finding a really effective way to play off of him. They're two of the most creative and savvy scorers you're ever going to see. And yeah, Kyrie can absolutely swing this series.
I do think if Kawhi plays, this could be, would you say this is the most fascinating matchup in the first round, both sides in the West and the East? I mean, and I know some people are talking about the Knicks and their matchup with the Sixers, but I do think Clippers-Mavs has my full attention. What do you say about that?
No, I think so. I think so in part because, look, no, these are two teams that nobody has bought into or people have been very slow to buy into for good reasons, right? The Mavericks have been all over the map the last couple of years. And, you know, obviously they basically decided to cash out and not even go for the play-in a year ago. And, you know, they've had an up and down playoff history. Their defense has been better since the moves at the deadline, but people around the league still don't necessarily trust that the Mavericks have, you know, consistently good defense. And the Clippers, of course, trust issues galore, right? 5 years in with the Paul George, Kawhi Leonard partnership, and whether it's injuries, whether it's bad luck, whether it's whatever, they just haven't been able to come through. And yet, if you ask people around the league, especially in the West, like, which teams, you know, might make a run, if it's not Denver, if you took Denver off the board, who's winning the West? I think you might get more votes for the Mavericks and Clippers than anybody else, and they're facing each other in the first round.
Yeah, so it's going to be a fascinating first round matchup. I'm excited to watch that, and you know, that could go seven games if everybody's healthy. For so sure. We're going to get some good basketball there. Let's look at the Timberwolves and the Sun. This is the 3 seed taking on the 6 seed. T-Wolves were battling for that 1 seed, ended up falling to the 3 seed, and now they face a team that they have struggled with. Timberwolves plus 116 in the series, Suns minus 136. The perimeter oriented Suns have given this team some fits, but we know that they have a lot of size. What do we expect to see here? Obviously a young Timberwolves team taking on a lot of all-stars there with the Phoenix Suns.
Yeah. This one's really, really interesting because this is a classic case of all the playoff experience is on one side for the most part. Yeah, the Timberwolves have been in a couple of first rounds and out, but the Suns have Kevin Durant and Devin Booker.
That helps.
But for me, it's this, Tate. Like, I look at this and I see, like, I understand, like, the Wolves, they're young. Karl Anthony Towns, no playoff, success to speak of. And whether you have doubts about him, whether you have doubts about Rudy Gobert, whether you just have doubts about the general makeup of the Timberwolves, like, I get all of that. But I lean Timberwolves in this series because the Suns have just been so unpredictable, so inconsistent. There's just no cohesion with this team. The idea of putting together two stars, or if you want to call Bradley Beal a star still, three, two and a half, whatever it is so that their combined firepower is so overwhelming that that nothing else almost matters. But the chemistry has to be there for that to work. And the Suns, they were the worst fourth quarter team, I think, in the entire league this season. Like, just really bad. And it's because they stagnate, the ball sticks, they don't know or haven't established a way to play off of each other well and really leverage each other's talents. So while the star power is on the Suns' side here, especially with Durant and Booker, it's not to say the Timberwolves don't have star power, by the way, obviously. Anthony Edwards is exploding off of our screens. But I think I trust the overall depth, cohesion, and experience together, the longevity together of the Timberwolves over the Suns.
And I've seen a lot of people talking about the Suns going small against this team, trying to get, you know, Rudy Gobert off the floor, trying to have Karl Towns, you know, have to deal with some matchups where he's guarding KD or guarding Grayson Allen or whatever the matchup may be. Do we think that's a factor that comes into play? Can Gobert get taken out of the series by the Suns? And then on the flip side, can they use their size to kind of impose their will on the Suns? You know, we're kind of looking at both sides of the coin there.
Yeah, I mean, it'll vary, obviously. You know, Nurkic is a beast in the middle there for the Suns to start.
He's
the
having
game.
Fun on Twitter these days as well. A lot of fun.
He is indeed. I appreciate that. You know, Nurkic Gobert is the matchup to start, and even that's kind of interesting. But yeah, you want Gobert. You know, his main function obviously is deterring everybody else. And so if they go small, and, you know, they do it out of necessity sometimes, too, right? Like, you know, there's just not a lot of size and trustworthy size on that Suns roster. So
we've seen KD at the five. Yep. They've done a lot of stuff.
Yeah. We'll see every version of it for sure.
Yep. Last one. We got the play-in preview here. We got Kings going to take on the Pelicans. Zion is going to be out for this game, talking about injuries that have kind of made us shake our heads a little bit. So unfortunately, he will not be playing. What do you expect to see here? And can the Kings go into New Orleans and get a win?
But the Kings haven't been able to beat the Pelicans all season. And most recently, within the last week, a home game that the Kings lost. So, but there's no Zion. So here we are back to the bummer bracket. and Brandon Ingram did not look good in their play-in game the other night.
Basically, got benched. Yeah.
And CJ McCollum was not good. So can a Zion-less Pelicans team get enough out of CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram, who, you know, just got back from injury, to beat the Kings? I'm doubtful. I'm very skeptical of the Pelicans' ability to pull this out at this stage. And it is a bummer that we're not, like, Zion just had one of the games of his life, of his career. It's just, you know, horrible to see him go out the way he did. I think the Kings break their futility streak against the Pelicans. I think they win this game.
Yeah, I like the Kings as well. One last thing, Howard, before we let you go. The Warriors, obviously, we saw the end of their season. There's a lot of conversation about what the future looks like. Steve Kerr says he wants to keep Klay Thompson. Draymond says he wants to keep Klay Thompson. Everyone's saying the right things to keep Klay Thompson, but I'm sure he's going to explore what his value is in the marketplace. Is this the end of the Warriors as we know it, or do we think that there's maybe a couple more years where they try to run it back?
I don't think it's the end of the Warriors as we know them. At minimum, I am fairly confident that Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and Steve Kerr will be there. So that's two of the three core players from the dynasty and the coach. They'll be pretty recognizable on that alone. The real question is just Klay. And it's a hard thing to prognosticate, right? Like, because there's so much going into this. This is not just financial. There have been times when a key player leaves a team simply because the team can't afford him anymore, or another team just wants to blow him out of the water. Klay's at a stage in his career that no one's offering him the max. So if the Warriors lose him, if it's a dispute over his paycheck, I guess that could happen. But, you know, look, sentimentality is really strong with that team. The bonds that are there are real. The feelings that they all have for each other. Steph Curry wants Klay Thompson, his splash brother, back. I think the whole organization does. So as long as Klay and the Warriors can come to an agreement on what a reasonable salary is for him at this stage of his career, post-Achilles and post-ACL, and possibly as a reserve going into next season, then I think he'll be back. And I think given how strongly Clay feels about this team and about the people he's been around, and also just, you know, it's rare in today's NBA to spend your entire career with one team, mm-hmm. and a team as special as this one has been. So, like, I think those are really strong pulls. And, you know, I, as you know, I'm not a betting person, but if I had to bet, I think Clay's back. Like, I think it would be really hard for either party to walk away from the other. And if the Warriors are going to get back into contention, it's going to have to be with other moves.
Yeah, and good for Bob Myers. He doesn't have to have that uncomfortable conversation with Clay. So, Mike Dunleavy, good luck to
good
him
luck,
for
Mike
doing
Dunleavy.
That. Yeah, exactly. Howard, where can we find all your work? And I appreciate you coming on the show, as always.
Of course, always on theringer.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Howard Beck. And, of course, on The Real Ones podcast with Logan Murdoch and Raja Bell every Monday.
I love it. Howard, you're the best. Thanks so much for coming on the show. On the other side, we got the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis joining us. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. I am still your host, Tate Frazier, and joining us now, the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis. Brian, welcome back to the show. Great to see you, man.
So glad to be here, and so glad you're still here, Tate Frazier.
Me too. I was worried after the break I wouldn't be back. So shout out to everybody at FanDuel TV for keeping me on, and shout out to you for coming on the show. There's a lot that is happening in the media landscape right now, Brian Curtis. We just got through the Final Four. We just got through the Masters. We were talking about that stuff. But there's also some interesting coverage going on with Caitlin Clark. And I do want to start there because Caitlin Clark is the talk of the town. Everyone's talking about Caitlin. In her first introductory press conference yesterday with the Indiana Fever, we had an interesting moment, which kind of made me immediately go, I need to get Brian Curtis's take on this. You are, you know, a savant in the media landscape. But it was an awkward encounter where a reporter for the Indy Star, Greg Doyle, had a very interesting kind of back and forth with Caitlin Clark. Then Twitter got their hands on it and it became a big moment. But let's start with just the press conference and the performative piece of it, because it has changed throughout the years. Now we have cameras in the press conference, and now we have moments like this that end up going viral. So what were your thoughts when you first saw this come out, you know, and get shared around?
I don't know about being a savant, but I am a student of the awkward sports press conference.
Yeah, right.
And I got to tell you, Tate, I've never seen anything that awkward or awkward in that particular way. Because mm-hmm. I had somebody text me yesterday and said, you know, usually when we have an awkward press conference moment, it's because a journalist is trying to ask a question that the athlete doesn't want to answer, or they think the athlete doesn't want to answer. Greg Doyle was trying to say hello. Like that was... We didn't even get to the question before the wheels completely came off that interaction. I've just never seen anything like that. And, you know, and you and I can go blow by blow through it here, but just, it was one of those moments where I truly think, my God, I don't think the form is broken so much, though that probably is also true, as much as this is just crazy, absolutely yeah. crazy and awful.
Right, and we'll go through the rundown. So it started with, if you haven't watched Caitlin Clark, at the end of game, she does the heart, like she makes a heart with her hands and does it to her family. So the reporter started by doing that to her, and then Caitlin kind of awkwardly said, you like that, you know what I mean? You know, in her best Kirk Cousins impression. And then he said, I like that you're here, and then it was kind of an even more of an awkward beat. And then Caitlin was like, I do that gesture to my family, which kind of gave him room to be like, you know, maybe I should pull off this. It's obviously something between her and her family. And then he said, start doing it to me and we'll get along just fine, end quote. And, you know, and then proceeded to tweet through it a little bit, talking about how many features he wanted to write on Caitlin Clark. Now you got that dynamic. If you're writing a feature on someone, as you know, it's a one-on-one kind of experience, which it puts Caitlin in an awkward position probably in the future. So just from that interaction alone, it just feels like now Caitlin's got like this other thing to deal with outside of all the expectations on the basketball court. And that's obviously a lot to put on her, especially someone that is now going to get her own signature shoe, be at the forefront of the conversation with the WNBA as she moves forward.
Yeah, I thought I detected a whiff too of old school sports columnist in that final comment, we'll get along fine. is if we still live in a world where an athlete comes to town, whether it's Caitlin Clark or Anthony Richardson of the Colts, and the local sports columnist says, you know, you need to deal with me here.
You need to know me, right? You need to play nice or like things could go bad for you, right? That was kind of the implication, right? Not to read too much into it.
It really was. Like, I got the ear of this town, you know, I got my readers. And my readers could, and this is what I'm imagining, you know, in Greg Doyle's statement there, going to turn on you, one of the most popular basketball players on the planet. Mm. Yeah, that's not really how it works anymore. And that was just an additional layer to the weirdness and the grossness of that whole exchange.
It was very strange, and I'm sure we'll get more follow-up to that. But just speaking generally about Caitlin Clark and the impact, the women's tournament, the national championship game, outrates. We love ratings, TV ratings. You and I kind of, you know, wink, wink, talk about them in a little bit of a joking way. But the ratings were great for the women's national championship game. First time that it outrates the men's national championship game. And now Caitlin Clark enters the WNBA, the number one pick, going to the Indiana Fever. She has 40 games, 36 of them, Brian Curtis, apparently are going to be on primetime, whether that's ABC, ESPN, TNT, whatever it is. She's going to be on primetime television. So we're going to see a lot of the WNBA and a lot of Caitlin Clark just from that impact alone. Just being in prime time, how accessible will she be, and how excited are we to see how that, you know, the ripple effect of her being in prime time?
Incredibly excited to see how it all plays out. And I'll tell you the number that really popped out to me, in addition to the NCAA tournament numbers, which were mind-boggling, was that number about the WNBA draft, where more than 2 million people watched it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at any of those NCAA tournament games and say, hey, there's a little bit of mystery here. You know, Caitlin Clark versus Dawn Staley's South Carolina team, Caitlin Clark versus LSU in kind of a game from last year. We saw that matchup twice, right? Like, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. In this case, you had like, it is absolutely foreordained that Caitlin Clark is going to go number one overall to the Fever. So what people are tuning in for is just to see her, right? There's no game. Mm-hmm. There's no mystery. We just want to tune in to get more of her. And to me, that was maybe the most striking number I saw.
Yeah, totally. And it was the most that we've seen, some of the ratings as far as the most that we've seen since Diana Taurasi was drafted back in her heyday, which is, you know, very funny when you look at like how the NBA works, which is like older guys basically take shots at the younger guys. Now we have Diana Taurasi taking shots at Caitlin Clark. So it is mirroring the men's game in some sense, and I think that could be good for everybody. And it'll be exciting to see how that plays out in the WNBA and for Caitlin Clark. So we will be tuning in. Let's talk about USA basketball, because there was a lot of Grant Hill going around, and it felt like NFL Hall of Fame, you know, when our guy goes around and gives everyone their jackets. But he was giving everyone their jerseys for Team USA this summer in Paris. And if you look at the roster, a whole lot of stars, Brian Curtis, LeBron, Steph, KD, Joel Embiid, AD, Devin Booker, Anthony Edwards, Jason Tatum, Drew Holiday, Bam Adebayo, Tyrese Halliburton, and of course, Kawhi Leonard is the last one on board. What were your thoughts of the rollout of Team USA? And is this a, you know, we've had the dream team, we've had the redeem team. Is there a nickname that we have for this group yet, and what do you expect to see this summer 100 days away?
That's funny. When I was a kid listening to sports radio in Dallas, after we had the actual dream team and then we rolled out the next team, which I believe was at the World Championships, the radio station labeled it Pretty Good Team, you know, because we were no longer, you know, there could only be one dream team, and then we're just doing right. variations on the dream team. This is pretty close to a dream team. I'm always interested to just think about, I mean, you and I are going to watch, you know, every second of Olympic basketball. So let's put us aside mm-hmm. for just a moment. I'm always interested in USA basketball and how it plays out, you know, within the whole panorama of the summer games. One, the Olympics is a little bit less of a thing than it was. Olympic basketball is always interesting because there is, I want to see the great stars of Team USA. And then I also want at least a little sense of something other than inevitability. We've right. seen that in previous
little
years.
Drama.
Some,
yep.
yeah, like, is there are they in danger, right? Because that to me is the sweet spot here. The best players the United States has to offer, plus some danger that these guys might actually go out and lose in Paris. Mm. And that is what I look forward to.
There's a chance.
Yeah, of course there is.
We've talked about this a lot just in the NBA about the international takeover. We've seen it in the World Cup. It used to be the World Championships. Now it's the World Cup starting back in like 2010. But we've seen, you know, the U.S., we just saw them in the fall go and lose. And then there was a lot of people kind of clutching their pearls. And now we get to the point where we have this super team. But if there is a world where they go there and they do not win with LeBron, with Steph, with Steve Kerr, do we really hit the panic button on USA basketball dominance? Because, I mean, since 2008, it's just been four straight gold medals for Team USA.
Is it, when you say we, do you mean you and I, or do you mean like the Chiron of every sports debate show?
I think when I say we, I mean like Stephen A. Smith, Skip Bayless, Shannon Sharp, you know what I mean?
Panic crowd. Buttons will be hit. Absolutely. Yeah, it will. And look, that's, you know, in a way that was, you know, going back to 1992, that was always the idea here, right? That we were going to see, you know, Olympic basketball, the best players in the world playing Olympic basketball, and that hopefully we could get to a scenario where it wasn't just, you know, Charles Barkley dunking on some hapless opponent, right? That it would be great competition. I think that's what I'm looking forward to. Also, Noah Eagles getting the call of USA basketball, by the way. Big moment for that guy.
Yeah.
Whose career has obviously been, you know, on a rocket ship already, and now he's getting to call basketball at the Olympics.
I think it's great when you know, you had the last name Eagle, you're calling USA basketball. I mean, I think there's some symmetry there that we all love to see, and I think people would be very excited. There has been some talk about who could have been that last roster spot. It ends up going to Kawhi because it sounds like he's going to be healthy enough to go play, but there was some talk about Cooper Flagg potentially being one of those guys, Paolo Banchero being one of those guys. I mean, Zion, one of those guys. Is there anyone that did not make this team that we feel would be a good use for the future of USA basketball? We've seen Leitner do this before. Anthony Davis did this in 2012, but is there a young guy out there that we're like, we should have put him on the team just for the sake of the future so we have some optimism?
It's a really good question. You know, the Christian Lettner slot from 92 is always fascinating to me because you look at that whole, right, you know, panorama and you're like, and Christian Lettner.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was there.
Do you like having the mandatory college slot just to give it a little bit of variety?
I think it's fun, and I think it also just gives people, like, one, we get to watch a guy learn in real time, and two, we get to see them kind of grow up. Brian Curtis, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about NFL analyst Bill Belichick and talk about the 2024 NFL draft. How do you feel about that? Does that sound good?
I am absolutely in.
Let's do it. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back on the other side here on Through the Ringer. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with Brian Curtis, and the NFL draft is right here. It's right around the corner, Brian Curtis, and this is a lot of coverage that we get for the NFL draft. So I want to start there. We got Detroit as the host city. You're a Texas guy. You love the Longhorns. Is there any player, either from Texas, outside of Texas, that you like going into this NFL draft, maybe from a storyline perspective or just like heading in there that you're just like, I like his game? Is there someone that sticks out to you?
Well, first of all, I just love the fact that there are actually Texas Longhorns in the high rounds of this draft. It's been a while, Tate. You know, the idea that Xavier Worthy and A.D. Mitchell could go. I mean, it's like offensive players, skill players. That's new. Jonathan Brooks, second, third round. This is all kind of a new world to me. Yeah, but Xavier Worthy, after he just lit the combine on fire, to me is one of the most interesting picks in the draft. And my Dallas Cowboys, if I may say so, are, you know, sitting there at 24. So it's always interesting. You know, do they go O-line or can they pick the exciting skill player? There's Texas players that could figure into that mix. That's kind of where my head and my heart are.
I like that. I like that as a pick. Quick tangent here. You just mentioned the Dallas Cowboys. I have to ask, just for my own, you know, Jerry Jones is involved in this Arkansas situation with John Calipari. How much have you kept up with Jerry Jones and his antics with his alma mater at Arkansas? Like, are you worried that he's maybe too invested in the Arkansas basketball program and not worried enough about the NFL draft, or do you feel okay?
I was going to say that could play both ways because, hey, there's something in Arkansas, Jerry, that we really need you to take care of next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. If you could just be out of the war room
just
for
go
a couple
over there.
Days.
Yeah.
We got this. So I could actually see it playing well for the Cowboys as opposed to playing badly.
Well, that's good. I'm happy that Jerry's finding other hobbies. That's good to see. I want to ask about the NFL draft coverage itself, because I do find it fascinating. It has become its own sort of media enterprise, right? There's so many people that are involved as draft experts. I mean, even here at The Ringer, we have our NFL draft show. Those guys do a great job. But we also have the coverage on different channels, ABC, ESPN, NFL Network. Pat McAfee's doing his own coverage. So as you, someone that is a media purveyor that is watching all this sort of stuff, do you check in on all these different coverages and broadcasts and try to figure out who's doing what and trying to, you know, piece together what's going on? Or do you just pick one and stick with it? Because I'm having a hard time deciding which one to pick, Brian.
It's very mind-blowing. I love turning over to ABC because what they do is they turn every pick into a game day feature story, which has the violins, and we're going into it. It's always something, and just, you know, a very, very sad story. And that I cannot roll with for very long. So usually the main ESPN broadcast. You make such a good point about how everybody became a draft expert, because one of the big things that changed over the last few years, when you and I, Tate, were coming up in the business of sports journalism, the way
cutting
you paid,
our teeth.
Yeah, cutting our teeth, the way you paid your dues and, you know, worked for a cigar chomping sports editor was you went and covered high school sports. That was the entry point. And what's changed in the last couple of years is, I think being a draft analyst is the new entry point. I mean, we could look at a bunch of people at the Ringer, but that's how you do it, right? You start getting on Twitter, you start posting those clips, you start grinding that tape. And it's not just become a job that a lot of people are doing. It's the way people get into the business, both in football and basketball.
Let's talk about the newest NFL draft analyst, Bill Belichick. That is right. Legendary head coach Bill Belichick is now a quote-unquote NFL draft analyst, and he's doing it with Pat McAfee. I just watched him on the show not too long ago here. He seemed very flattered by the position. He enjoyed being on the show. What are your thoughts on Bill Belichick, the media personality, as opposed to Bill Belichick, the coach? Because they do seem very much different. Jim Boeheim, by the way, has done this as well. He went from a curmudgeon as the coach, but now he's a very affable guy as the commentator. So Bill Belichick kind of fallen in that same line. What have you seen so far, and what do you think about him as an analyst?
Well, the first bit of fascination with that McAfee appearance is, what will Bill Belichick's Zoom window look like?
What's behind him? Yeah.
Yeah. And it felt, well, yeah. So we had the little trophy replicas behind him, but he was also sitting like way too low in the Zoom. The camera was at a weird angle. Like that is exactly what I thought talking to Bill Belichick on Zoom would be like, you know, would not be lit in a certain way. It's almost like that COVID draft where we got to see him at the table, or got to see the dog at the table.
Right. Yeah.
That was it. You know, to me, the thing with Belichick is like the thing with Nick Saban, who's going to be on ESPN coming up this year too, is, will you get the honest Bill Belichick? You know, will you get him saying things about teams and players and organizations? Because if you get that, even no matter what Bill Belichick's draft record was like for the last five or so years, that's really fascinating. Like, that is what I want. I remember Jimmy Johnson sat in on ESPN's coverage. I think it was only 1 year, and it was amazing because, you know, Mel Kiper was like genuflecting to Jimmy. Jimmy, you understand the draft. And Jimmy was like, you know, I called a bunch of people and then I went fishing for a couple weeks. But like that level of expertise and involvement, I am curious, to say the least.
Especially when Bill Belichick's MO as a coach was to lie, right? I mean, that was the whole point, was, or at least to like hide what his actual feelings were, whether it be about a player or strategy or whatever it is. It was very like behind the scenes, behind the veil was very much how he approached things. Brian Curtis, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Masters and TV ratings, something we both love talking about, and a little bit about O.J. Simpson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with Brian Curtis. We've been bouncing around talking about all types of subjects, but I do want to talk about one of the subjects that is just, you know, a jumping off point in media in general. You and I, years ago, I was producing at the time, but we worked on this press box feature about O.J. Simpson back during the Made in America, the FX TV series, and we talked to the likes of Jim Lampley and all these people that were connected to O.J. Simpson. He obviously just passed away. And the media, the fallout, I want to talk about the media coverage of the situation. We got, like, on one sense, the Heisman Trophy says, you know, rest in peace, O.J. Simpson, which seemed pretty harmless. But then obviously there's backlash. Then we get the coverage on ESPN where they put like a disclaimer, you know, that, you know, he was charged or, you know, accused of a murder and all this sort of stuff. So just the fallout of O.J.'s death and the media coverage of that. What were your thoughts, and how do you, as a media corporation or company, entity, whatever, try to figure out and parse through that story? Because obviously there's a lot of layers to it.
It was so fascinating. And even just going to the basic obituaries that ran in the New York Times and the Washington Post, O.J. Simpson, comma, who was charged with two murders, comma, you know, I mean, it was very, very hedged in a lot of ways. And I think it's you know, sort of illustrative of how we've talked about OJ basically since the '90s, you know, and, mm-hmm. and this is somebody who's basically just eaten up headlines and minutes on podcasts and documentaries since then. I mean, we were reminded as I'm sure you were, that 95 million people watched the Bronco Chase in 1995. Yeah. 95 million. That's a Super Bowl audience. And I got to tell you, Tate, my favorite detail was that OJ tried to call Bob Costas from the Bronco. He wanted to call him. He got through to the NBC switchboard, and the NBC switchboard was like, yeah, right, OJ Simpson, and hung up on the most wanted television guest of all time. Unbelievable.
Yeah, during the middle of the 1995, right, NBA Finals going on with the Knicks and the Rockets. I mean, yeah. It was just a crazy time, and it really is like an American Shakespearean tragedy that we all watched with television and with all the media that comes along with it. So very interesting. And Brian Curtis, we appreciate everybody tuning in to Through the Ringer. We will be back on Tuesday with Cousin Sal, and we will see you then.